On the night of January 10, 2009, 43-year-old Jerome Loach was performing as one of the leads in a church play in South Philadelphia. At the same time, police were responding to a home invasion in West Philadelphia, in which two men forced themselves into a home at gunpoint, confronting three women. Nothing was stolen, and no one was hurt. As police arrived, they saw two men running away and arrested Sophie Batt and Jesse Higgins. One of the victims stated that there was a third man involved, and in Batt's original statement, he said that he didn't know the person. But under threat of deportation and other charges by investigators, Batt changed his story to say that the third man was his employer at a barbershop, Jerome Loach. Jerome was arrested and charged with 42 counts. But prior to trial, Batt recanted his identification, citing pressure from investigators. Despite this, the prosecution read Batt's prior statement to the jury. In light of the actual exculpatory phone records, an investigator misled the jury with fabricated phone records to tie Jerome into the crime. When the defense failed to present Jerome's alibi or to expose the fake phone records, Jerome was convicted and sentenced to 25 to 50 years. Jerome was able to win an evidentiary hearing in which he was able to present his alibi and expose the fraudulent phone records, proving both ineffective assistance of counsel and prosecutorial misconduct, ultimately setting himself free after a decade in prison. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm your host, Jason Flom. Today's episode would actually be better as a comedy if it wasn't so incredibly sinister and if the consequences weren't so terrible of this ridiculous frame job. And when I say that, I'm talking about Jerome Loach. So Jerome, first of all, welcome to Wrongful Conviction. I'm sorry you're here, but I'm happy you're here.
Thank you and the audience for allowing me to come before y'all and share my story.
So, Jerome, you grew up in Philadelphia, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Fill us in. What was your life like growing up, and what were your interactions with law enforcement before this crazy day?
Essentially, I grew up in a single-parent household. My father passed away when I was about 10 years old. That left my mother to raise six children. I took to the streets at a very young age. I wound up getting caught up in little knick-knack crimes. Nothing serious, but just getting caught up with the wrong crowd. All my other siblings, they wound up growing up to become successful entrepreneurs, ministers. My brother, he went on to serve 25 years in the Army. And so I was the only one that made that wrong turn. I was young at the time. I served my time. And during my incarceration, I went to the University of Pittsburgh, went to college. I wound up getting a couple of trades. One of the main trades was in barbering, and I wound up getting my license. I transformed that and wound up getting my manager's license. And so when I come back home, I wound up getting into real estate and opening up a barbershop. Once I opened up the barbershop, I felt the need to want to give back. And so those individuals that was returning home, ex-offenders and things of that nature who had their barber license, I would hire them in my barbershop, you know, give them like a second chance. Like I got a second chance, try to get their life in order. And in doing this, one individual that I wound up hiring was an individual by the name of Sophie Fat. And this is how this story in my life began to take a change.
Yeah, it adds a layer of tragedy to this awful injustice because it impacted you and your family, but also the opportunities that you were providing for people who really needed those opportunities. Let's go back to the case itself. So at 9:15 on January 10th, 2009, the Philadelphia police responded to a report of a home invasion in the Cobbs Creek neighborhood of West Philadelphia. Now, three women were in the house, and they said that a man knocked on their door pretending to be a pizza delivery guy. He and another man forced their way in at gunpoint. But here's where it gets really weird, right? They asked one of the women where her boyfriend was. She said she didn't know, and soon they left without taking anything, sort of apologetically, from what I understand. They were like, you know, sorry we bothered you type of thing. I mean, and in the end, nobody was hurt, and nothing was stolen, okay? Very unusual set of circumstances here. So then the police approached the house and they saw two guys running away, and they arrested two guys, a guy named Sophie Fatt and Jesse Higgins. They recovered a bandana and a gun holster from Higgins and a tourist revolver from an alley where Higgins was found running. The women identified both of the guys as the home invaders and said that during the invasion, this is an important point, Higgins had received a call and turned to Fatt and said, "Let's go," right before they left. Eventually, they were both charged with burglary and conspiracy to commit burglary. So one of the women said there was a third person, a black man in his 20s, about 6 feet tall with a tan jacket and jeans, who got away. Now, she told police that one of the other women might have known this man, implying that the home invasion had been a setup. Sophie Fatt made a statement to Detective John Druding on January 11th that he didn't know who this third man was, besides that his nickname was Rome. So, Jerome, did you match the description of that person in any meaningful way?
No. I'm about twice that age number at that particular time. I'm mid-40s. My build, everything was totally opposite. Nothing about her description matched me. And we know that to be true because afterwards, a year or so later, when my picture was given to all the victims, they all said they couldn't identify me, that they didn't know who I was. Sophie Fatt, in his original statement, he never said that there was three people that came in the house. He said that it was another person that was involved in the planning and that this person came to the house but never came in the house. Sophie Fatt also stated that he was upstairs and he came downstairs. And that's when the second person, Jesse, said, "We have to go." Sophie Fatt never claimed in his first statement that he heard a phone call, he's seen a phone call, none of that.
And Jesse, of course, is Jesse Higgins, who was Sophie Fatt's co-defendant. And in October of that year, it had been 10 months since the crime, Sophie Fatt made a deal with prosecutors. And this happens again and again, where people receive almost an offer they can't refuse in exchange for implicating basically anybody else. So in this new statement, Fatt now said that you, Jerome, were involved in the invasion and were the person he had previously identified as Rome. He said that you persuaded him to commit the home invasion to pay off a debt, and that you had been there during the robbery, had given Fatt, who posed as a pizza deliverer, a gun, and had texted Higgins during the crime. So, what do you think caused him to finger you? I mean, other than the obvious, which was that he had to pick someone out if he wanted to take some of the heat off of himself.
Well, I don't know what was in Fatt's mind, but what I do know is that Fatt came under a lot of pressure from the police officers. They was threatening with deportation. They was threatening with 50 years, all types of stuff.
And yeah, it's sad because you were a guy who had given Fatt an opportunity working in your barbershop. So it's almost like a Shakespearean twist to this whole thing for him to come forward and implicate you. So this crazy case began under District Attorney Lynn Abraham, who was wrapping up a very checkered 20-year tenure, to say the least. But her successor was the newly elected Seth Williams. And when he picked up this case, he decided to make it an example of how tough on crime he was. And so, Jerome, on December 19, 2009, you were charged with 42 counts related to the incident, including two counts of robbery and single counts of criminal conspiracy, burglary, false imprisonment, terroristic threats, and attempted theft. But neither Fatt nor Higgins had been charged with the majority of these alleged crimes. And then you were arrested January 4th, 2010. But here's the thing. We haven't even scratched the surface on this insanity, because what adds another huge layer to all of this is your alibi, your airtight alibi. I mean, in a world of alibis, yours was truly top tier. If someone can get convicted with an alibi like yours, then nobody is safe from this. So tell us what you were doing at exactly the time that this crazy situation was unfolding.
At the time that this whole thing was unfolding, I was performing in a play called Clean Up Your Own Mess. It was a church play, and it had two viewings, one during the afternoon and one during the evening time. I'm one of the lead characters in this play. You know, billboards, pay stubs, everything showing that I'm at this play. And while I was at this play, this crime was going on.
So how many people were there?
You know, we're looking at over 100 people or so that was there at this play.
So again, there's not too many cases I've ever heard of where you have over 100 alibi witnesses. Now, your first attorney didn't even investigate the alibi, right? Which would not be a difficult alibi to investigate. I mean, you throw a stick out there and you'd hit one of the witnesses. So you replaced her and the new attorney said he would investigate it and present it at trial. But as the case approached the time of trial, that attorney told you and your family that he couldn't present his alibi defense because the first attorney failed to give adequate notice to the court. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But there you were heading into your trial, and there's yet another statement from Sophie Fatt. Please tell us about that.
So once he gave his statement, a month later, he gave another statement. And guess what? It exonerated me of everything. Before I even go to trial, before anything happens, he said, hey, hold up. I lied. This man never had nothing to do with this case. I made it up because I was trying to get a better deal. And so when we go to trial, he takes the stand and he told them over after he was badgered by the DA. He said, listen, this man ain't had nothing to do with this case. I lied. And they didn't want to believe that. They went so far as to say that I may have gotten somebody to get at him. Well, that didn't work because he wound up saying, hey, I'm the leader of an Asian gang and I'm not afraid of none of this. He hasn't been threatened, that no one has been approached. They didn't want to believe that.
So two of the women testified and didn't identify you. Fat came clean and said that you had nothing to do with this, that he had lied previously because he was threatened with deportation. And then Higgins, who pleaded guilty, didn't testify at all. So the prosecutors had basically nothing to go on at this point. So they had to make up something, right? And that's where these phantom phone records come in. We've been doing this show for over 5 years, 250 episodes or whatever. I don't think I've ever heard this one. Just follow along with me for a second here, okay? So prosecutors use phone records to try to show that you were involved, right? What they actually showed was that you weren't involved. The original records they subpoenaed in 2009 were almost completely exculpatory for you. Higgins's phone showed no local calls at all on the day of the crime. So that blows it up right there. Then the police assumed that the records were wrong. So they weren't introduced into evidence. Let me just say that again. Police assumed that the records, which weren't wrong, because they couldn't have been wrong, were wrong. Then they used a digital tool called a universal forensic extraction device to get records directly from the phone. But this also showed no calls or texts between Higgins and you on the day of the crime. So, okay, again, should be case closed. But nope. So this is where Detective Christopher Tankelowicz ended up going into Higgins's phone and looking at the call log. Now, at trial, he testified as an expert in digital forensics, said that he, quote, manually extracted 25 calls between the phone allegedly belonging to Higgins and a phone registered to Loach's wife. He manually extracted them, but I'm trying to figure out what that means. He also said he found a text from the Loach phone to the Higgins phone made a few hours before the home invasion. And this info was contained in a quote-unquote supplemental report that Detective Tankelowicz attached to the UFED report. So, I mean, Jerome, what the hell, man?
This here, it pains me to talk about it a lot of times. Essentially, what happened was that because the young lady said that there was a phone call, they needed something to corroborate that. They then got Sophie Fatt. And then instead of Sophie Fatt saying that it was a phone call, he slips and say that it was a text message and it's on record now. Had that never came out, I probably still would be doing 50 years in prison. Detective John Drewdy, he was the lead detective on this case. And he was the one who obtained the phone records a year before I even got arrested. Sophie Fatt and Mr. Higgins was already convicted a year before me, and so Drewdy.
goes on the stand. He's talking and saying things about the phone records. So we had to get what he says then and compare it to what he's saying a year later now. And so when he got the phone records back then, he said that there was no local phone calls on Mr. Higgins' phone records. He then looked at Sophie Fett's phone records, and there was, again, no phone calls between us. So that was a problem. He then turned around, and he got with a detective named Christopher Tankelowitz. He was a detective who moonlighted as an expert in forensics. Mr. Tankelowitz had the phone records from AT&T and Sprint. Both of these phone companies basically said there is no phone calls during this time period that equates Mr. Loach's phone to these phones. None. Not only that, the phone company said this phone itself do not have the capabilities to make texts, but they withheld all of that. Tankelowitz said, let's use a universal forensic extraction device. This is the device that FBI and everybody else uses to extract information from phones and computers. And he plugged that into the phone. And in 2 minutes, it extracted no phone calls. And this is what Tankelowitz testified to. After the report that none of this stuff was in that phone, he then picked up the phone a day, 2 days later, and miraculously, he sees 25 phone calls and a text message all around the time of this crime.
So he saw 25 calls that AT&T had incontrovertible evidence never happened, and a text message that AT&T said the phone was incapable of sending. I mean, this is really dark stuff.
And it gets crazier because we say Higgins' phone, well, that was a lie. It wasn't even his phone. Sprint wind up sending records saying that Higgins never owned the phone, that this phone that they're looking at belongs to someone else.
Wow.
And they misrepresented the facts. They concealed the evidence, you know, and they made it all appear to be something that it wasn't. Sprint records came back and said, those was no 25 calls. AT&T said, those wasn't 25 calls. AT&T said, that phone can't even text. But that's where, when you say manually extract, that sounds real technical. But all he did was pick the phone up and looked at it. A phone that's supposedly been sitting in evidence for over a year. So you saying that every other police officer or detective before Tankelowitz who had that phone looked at this phone and they didn't see none of this? Because Detective Drewling said that in order for him to get the phone number from that phone, he had to turn it on and look through the phone. And he said he could not find nothing in the phone.
That's because there was nothing in the phone. And it still gets crazier from here because the police also had Mr. Fatt's phone records, which showed a call at 1:22 and 9:07 to the phone registered to your wife, right? Because he was somebody who worked for you and you knew him, right? But equally important, the phone continued to be used after Fatt's arrest at 9:20 p.m. on January 10th, 2009. So Detective Druding testified that Fatt would have had his phone confiscated upon arrest. Of course he would. And he was unable to explain these additional calls. That's crazy. So the prosecutor closed by referencing the text from you to Higgins and said that the phone records showed a coordinated effort by the three of you, Loach, Fatt, and Higgins. He said, quote, at 9:07 p.m., the robbery is underway. Sophie Fatt is in the middle of this robbery. Who does he call? He calls the defendant. Why would he do that? Ladies and gentlemen, there were 25 phone calls that day. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't remember the last time I called someone 25 times in a day. The only way that's happening, something very important must be happening. Think about it. Something in your life, you know, a baby, you know, a job promotion, you get on the phone, you keep calling people. Well, this robbery is important. It's important to the defendant. It's important to Fatt and Higgins, end quote. What a steaming pile of bullshit that is. Oh my God. That's the quote from the closing argument. What is wrong with these people? So during deliberations, jurors asked to review the cell phone records for Higgins. Prosecutors told the judge that they didn't have the actual record, just the supplemental report. So they withheld the real records. They substituted this quote unquote supplemental report. And that was what was given to the jurors. I actually feel sick for the jurors because they were sitting there having no ability to make a decision based on facts.
You absolutely hit it on the nail. I do not fault the jury. They only go on what is presented before them. And the jury asked three times, we want to see those phone records from Sprint. And that's when the DA said, Your Honor, we don't have those. And the judge was kind of like taken aback, like, huh? Well, what was we using during the trial? He said, oh, that was a report that was prepared by the detective. And the judge said, well, they don't want to see that. They want to see the actual phone records. And so they asked the jury, listen, we don't have the phone records. Do y'all want to see the report? That's the only thing we have. And the jury took this and they convicted me. I do not fault the jury for what they did because they only went on what was presented before them.
So the jury convicted you of criminal conspiracy on May 27, 2011, but acquitted you on all the other charges. So that moment when the jury came back in, I mean, you had seen what these people were capable of, and you'd been through a lot of insanity already. Did you still hold out hope that you were going to be exonerated and the truth would come out? And what was it like to find out that you were going to prison for 50 years?
I honestly believe I was going to be exonerated because I knew I was innocent. But when that verdict came back, it took everything out of me. The only way that I can explain it, my soul was stripped. When they gave me 50 years, I couldn't believe this. I said, I know my life ain't going to end like this. Is y'all kidding me? Like, wake me up. Is this a nightmare? I went in fighting because I said, if I'm going to die in here, I'm going to die fighting. And twice my life almost came to an end while being in prison. The psychological and physical torture that I experienced while being incarcerated, I'm subjected to being in the cell by myself because of psychological issues that I have been dealing with, PTSD and things of that nature. And one day I fell out in my cell. Out completely. 9, 10 o'clock at night, I had to be rushed to the hospital, outside hospital, in which I stayed for a few days. My blood pressure shot to the roof. I can recall the doctor said, why is your blood pressure so high? I said, why did y'all convict me? That's why my blood pressure is so high. And so another incident is when I couldn't walk no more than 100 feet before I would pass out. And no one could understand why I wound up being admitted to the hospital for a couple of weeks this time. I wound up learning that I have a severe case of anemia. So now I have to take medication for the rest of my life to help me throughout the day. And so all these things that I have been experienced with the stress and loss of loved ones and things of this nature, like it just tormented me beyond torment. I can't describe it. I don't wish this on my worst enemy, what they done to me, you know?
I can't even imagine. But during this time, you're also pursuing your claims of innocence. And Michael Pileggi began representing you after you had filed pro se motions. And I know you had appealed the conviction, arguing that a potential juror had been dismissed due to his race. That Vatt's out-of-court statement was too unreliable to be admitted into evidence. Sounds like you became a pretty good lawyer in prison yourself. And in fact, you went so far, and I love this part of the story, to send a subpoena to Higgins' phone company, Sprint, including one where you referred to yourself as the law office of Jerome Loach. I love that.
Yes, that's how the phone records begin to unravel. What I did was I had the love of my family still out here in society, still to this day. And my brother went down to City Hall and for $5, he got me some subpoenas from the courthouse and sent them back up to the prison. And I filled those subpoenas out and I subpoenaed the phone company. Well, they thought I was working with the DA's office. And they wind up sending me the phone records saying that Mr. Higgins doesn't have a phone registered to them. That blew my mind, because all through my trial transcripts, that's all they talking about is that the police subpoenaed Mr. Higgins' phone records. So I said, well, hold on. If they don't have no phone records for Mr. Higgins, then who is these phone records? So then I had to do another subpoena. And this time I subpoenaed the name that was used for this phone. And it wound up coming back to a female. And I said, wow, they had this and they didn't tell me. And that's when I started learning about the 25 phone calls that never existed, the text messages that never existed. It, like, everything began to unravel from that point.
So they were making up calls from a phone that didn't exist. I mean, the layers of misconduct is a word I'm going to use, but it's stronger than that. And what eventually happened is that after all of this stuff came to light, prosecutors tried to push back. They said that your claims were speculative, but the state said it would not oppose an evidentiary hearing about whether the trial attorney was ineffective for failing to secure the testimony of alibi witnesses. A little victory there. At the hearing, your lawyer, Pileggi, presented evidence of your incredibly powerful alibi, including the playbill that mentioned your role in the production that was distributed to the 100-plus people who attended the show at the church. So there was literally a 0% chance you could have been in both places at the same time. And so on July 24, 2020, Judge Tracy Roman Brandeis vacated your conviction and ordered a new trial. She said that your attorneys had been ineffective and that the state had engaged in misconduct by failing to disclose accurate phone records. So this is not me saying it. This is the judge. And prosecutors with the DA's Conviction Integrity Unit under the great Larry Krasner agreed that there were problems with the conviction, but they still didn't want to dismiss the case yet. They offered you a deal to plead guilty to a reduced charge and become eligible for parole. Now, I know you turned it down, but did you even give it a second thought? That's a hard decision to make, right?
Well, my lawyer, he fought with me. You know, he was very concerned about me just getting out, like not doing the 50 years. And he was doing what any lawyer would do and say, hey, listen, this may be a good one. We can roll the dice and things can have bad luck again. I didn't think twice, because if you won't convict me, then you're going to have to do this again, because I didn't do this. And I'm ready to prove my innocence. I think that he saw that and he was convinced and he gave me his full support and said, well, let's move forward. And we moved forward. The judge came back and said there was a constitutional violation in this man's case. There was a serious, egregious Brady violation. Y'all withheld these records. And not only that, this man had a bona fide alibi defense. Woo! That sent me to the moon. The main thing that I think that was so telling was how the judge came back with the Brady claim and the violation of the constitutional right, that this was an unfair trial, that they concealed those phone records, that they misrepresented those records. I think that she really gave me what I would consider justice.
Well, listen, it's a beautiful ending to a truly miserable story. And of course, on June 24th, 2021, almost a year later, the state of Pennsylvania dismissed the charges, stating that the prosecutors had admitted that they had insufficient evidence to move forward with a retrial. You had already been released on house arrest since the judge's decision, but now you're a free man. And on July 13th, 2021, you filed a lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia, as well as against Detective Ted Kellowitz and Detective Druding in U.S. District Court, seeking compensation for your wrongful conviction. And Jerome, let's talk about that, because to this date, you've received exactly $0 in compensation. Is that right?
Yes, I have received no compensation whatsoever. They kicked me out the prison and said, there you is, you're out of here. After a decade or more being incarcerated, losing all my finances, lost property, things of that nature. And now my family has put together a GoFundMe to help me try to rebuild my life. And so the only thing now that I have going for me to help me at this particular time
There's a GoFundMe page that people, if they want, they can support me.
So we're going to have the GoFundMe linked in our episode bio. Please take a moment right now. Don't wait. If you got anything you can spare, it would help a lot to try to make it through the next phase before Jerome hopefully wins this civil trial. But that's not a certainty. So please go to the link in our bio, click on the GoFundMe, and join me and our team in donating to help Jerome and his family. So listen, you're a strong man, and I know you're a great example of the power of human redemption. You're a courageous guy. And I know I speak for our audience and our whole team here at Wrongful Conviction when I say that you have all of my respect for standing strong and for being here with us today and sharing your story so eloquently and powerfully. So now we have the closing of the show, which is my favorite part of the show, and everybody knows it by now. And the reason is because it's called Closing Arguments, and it works like this. I thank you again for being here and sharing your story, and then I'm going to turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my headphones on, leave your mic on so you can share with us any other thoughts you have about whatever else you want to talk about.
I would like to take this opportunity to once again thank the Wrongful Conviction Podcast for allowing me this opportunity to come before this audience. One of the things that I will hope that anyone who's listening will begin to do is focus in on phone records. Phone records is so very important. And if you don't understand how this goes, you need to start learning about phone records. They can be manipulated. They can be altered, changed. You got to make sure that when going in that courtroom, when a DA or your lawyer or whoever it is talk about phone records, they have to authenticate those phone records. Make sure that those phone records are accurate and it's not a report being disguised as phone records. There's a big distinction with certification of phone records coming directly from the phone company and those records that are being developed and created by detectives or officers who are moonlighting as expert witnesses. They still may have a hidden agenda. Thank you and God bless.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Justin Golden, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all 3 platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.